Blackstone Publishing has a new horror novel out that I wanted to tell y'all about before we start the show. This shivery, queer psychological horror from H. Lee Justine, evocatively set in the secluded islands of the Pacific Northwest, combines the bite of Jessica Knoll with the twists of Colleen Hoover's Verity and the atmospheric tension of The Haunting of Bly Manor. A gothic haunting filled with mysterious symbols, animal sacrifices, and apparitions. You Watched in Silence will leave you feeling like you're descending into madness with the main character and keep you turning the pages deep into the long, dark winter night. You Watched in Silence is out in the world now. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, babies, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door four times a year. Each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KINKASS to check out, you will save a whopping astronomical, gigantic, massive, Godzilla-sized 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINKASS. Now on with the show.
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KINKASS on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts.
Your host.
Host. One of these days, we will accidentally line up when we do that, and it will be a glorious day. There will be celebrations in the streets.
I felt like you were giving me a prompt like to say it in unison with you.
I was seeing if today was going to be the day. Today was not the day, but it is a day where we are taking a little trip to a quaint small town in 1970s North Carolina that houses some dark secrets, as quaint small towns are apt to do. One of those secrets is a shoddy amusement park that may or may not have a ghost problem in its horror house. Of course, we're talking about Joyland, and joining us are a pair of writer-directors who have a fun low-budget horror movie headed your way on December 5th on VOD and in select theaters called Man Finds Tape. This isn't your run-of-the-mill found footage movie, as you might think from the title. It's more of an investigation into why the residents of a small Texas town go into a mass catatonic state every so often. The movie plays around with some very heavy Stephen King tropes, like the untrustworthy preacher, mysterious men in long coats, and holes where there shouldn't be holes. We'll talk about that and King's often overlooked Joyland. Please welcome writer-directors Peter Hall and Paul Gandersman to the KINKASS. Welcome, gents.
Welcome, fellas.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. Honestly.
Mm.
Eric, you know, I think correctly described it as the people are going to see it as a found footage movie. But what I thought was cool is that it's really, to me, more of a taking the format and the cadence, the language of true crime documentaries and making that into a fantasy horror, thriller, mystery. I don't want to say exactly what it is because that's part of the fun of Man Finds Tape. But were you deliberately leaning into that? Because when I hear found footage, I think literally found footage. We found these tapes in the woods and these three students disappeared because of the Blair Witch. Or we found this footage of the suburban house that has some paranormal activity. But what you have is really, it's constructed. It's the story of this family, of this town, and it's in the language of films and TV shows that delve into like some sort of true wrongdoing.
Yeah, we always intended for it to be a fake documentary. We didn't look at any one specific style and say like, oh, we're going to do what The Jinx did, or we're going to do what this Netflix true crime series did. The North Star for it is, of course, Lake Mungo, an Australian fake documentary, if you've ever seen it. That's a great horror movie. It's a slower burn. But it was very interesting sort of full circle for this, because when we wrote it, when we first conceived of it, it was going to be a fictional podcast of them going to this town to investigate these strange events. And then when we decided to make it as a movie, we kind of wrote a standard found footage version of it where it was just, here is the events in the footage. And then we had to then rewrite it as, okay, if you found that footage, how would documentarians approach it and make it into a documentary? So it's sort of evolved several different times and then ended up being feeling more of like a found footage movie in a way than we were expecting. We thought we might get away from it, and then we had to really sort of embrace it in the end.
Well, there is found footage in documentaries, right? It's like, here's the security camera. This is a home movie. This is something that somebody had. So that is an aspect of that genre of storytelling. There's always, you know, the archival footage, right?
So this is Paul, by the way, the previous voice was Peter.
There will be a quiz at the end of this, by the way. Yeah, so everybody must remember to attribute the right things to the right people.
We're indie filmmakers through and through, you know, and Peter and I had been trying to get another movie going for years that was way bigger. That was, we actually ended up turning it into a novel called The Dead Friend Society. And so we started on this project trying to figure out something we could do that nobody could say no to us on. And so we talked about, what do we have that's advantageous to us? And I've been working in sports documentaries for about a decade or more as the day job. And so we just started talking about, well, I know how to produce documentary. We've got a documentary editor, documentary cinematographer, and shooting a quote unquote documentary allows for a lower budget because things shouldn't be lit perfectly, right? It shouldn't look like Hollywood. And so that was kind of just the starting point on what kind of story do we feel like we can tell where we can control all parts of it. And so, yeah, then we kind of like pulled out of a digital drawer, like Peter was saying, like that old concept for a fictional podcast, and kind of realized, oh, well, this could work.
Yeah, we loved the idea of very literal found footage, as you were saying, Bresnikan, where it's someone who comes across a tape and then falls down the rabbit hole of figuring out what's in it. Because, you know, in this day and age of the internet in particular, it's very easy to go down a Reddit rabbit hole of like, oh, what is this weird video? What is this strange conspiracy? What is this? And sort of we wanted to tap into that and make that experience for the viewer. And it fit our themes of what we were doing, what the actual tape was, what the purpose of the sort of sinister plans going on in this town. Like, it all sort of created this feedback loop that worked really well with the style of the film.
Well, really, I think just trying to figure out how do you tell this kind of a story in this age, in this year, right? When literally everything is filmed constantly. And I don't know about you guys, but my default now is if I see something, some crazy video clip, my default is to assume it's fake first. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I need it proven that it's real, which is so weird and backwards that I can't really wrap my head around it. I feel like the world has turned me into a conspiracy theorist, right? Like, it's just like, that's not the kind of guy I am, but it's like forced me to be, to like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Double check everything.
AI especially has made it so even the most rudimentary thing is probably fake. You know, I got into, a friend sent me a couple of weird cat videos. He's like, can you believe this? And I'm like, that's AI, man. It's like where there's like a cat cake on the counter. Have you seen this one?
No.
It's like a realistic looking cat cake, but obviously frosting, and the amused cat owner is like slicing into it with a big Michael Myers knife, and the actual cat on the counter starts wigging out and jumping around the room. And to watch it, you might assume, like 5 years ago, you'd be like, oh, that's weird that the cat thought that was a real cat and not a cake, but it's just fake. It's just, and you can, and I'm like, look, you can see when it hits the glass, like the reflection doesn't move, like there's something wrong here. And you know, this is sort of like back in the hoax days of War of the Worlds, right, where everybody could hear something, and there are people who believe it because they believe in that medium, right? Well, if it's on the radio, it must be true. If there's video of it, it must be true. And we're entering this era now where I think it's the opposite, where, oh, actually, if I'm seeing it and hearing it, it might be fake. It's most likely fake, so I need to double check.
It's also
you have to see it with your own eyes, right? And like, I think the weird thing for Peter and I is we kind of started writing this project before the AI boom. Like, the movie's not about AI. Like, just to anybody listening, if you're sick of AI stuff, it's not what it's about. There's no AI used in it. We don't say the words AI. But it's just become more and more and more thematically relevant as time has passed from conceptualizing the project to now releasing it.
What's cool about your movie is it's about, can you believe your lying eyes? Can you believe what you see? And if you can't prove it, what do you do then? It's like you say, it's not just, can you believe, you only believe the things you see with your eyes. It's almost like a hallucination. You have to turn to somebody else and say, are you seeing this too? Right? Because we can't all see everything at all by ourselves. We have to trust somebody. So, you know, this movie is about trying to find verification of what is on this strange found footage. And can you guys yourselves describe as deep as you want the premise of Man Finds Tape? Because I don't want to give away too much for people. But if you were to dive a little into the plot, how far do you go to explain what's going on with your story?
My usual pitch is that it's a film about a brother and sister investigating a strange piece of footage in their small Texas town that sends them down a rabbit hole. But I think it's safe to say that the footage itself is of a 20-something who finds a videotape in his barn that has his name on it, and he loads it up, and it's footage of someone coming into his room as a child and feeding him something that we can't quite tell what it is. And so it's just a very unpleasant experience for him that he has no memory of. And that's the initial Man Finds Tape. But then there's a sort of series of other tapes that the people who are in the footage cannot remember the events taking place. And so then it becomes a much more slow burn horror story, increasingly cosmic in nature of what is happening to this small town and why. And the sister is a documentarian, so she starts to document what's happening. I think that's a pretty safe ballpark. What about that, Paul?
Yeah, I think too. It's really the movie was produced by Rustic Films, which is David Lawson, Justin Benson, Aaron Moorhead. I know you guys have had Benson and Moorhead on the show in the past, and if anybody in the audience is familiar with their films, they're weird, creepy puzzles, right? And that's what we created here. And honestly, what they really encouraged us to do was kind of keep taking pieces out of the puzzle, trying to find that magic balance of weird and creepy enough, and you can wrap your head around most of it, but there's some pieces unanswered. And we did that intentionally, hoping that the audience would want to engage with it, have opinions, theories, that sort of thing. And we know everything that's going on in it, but it's intended to be a puzzle where we don't give you every single answer.
Well, there comes a point where the creepy stuff isn't just found on these old like mini DV tapes, essentially, where suddenly the supernatural stuff starts popping up in the new documentary that's being shown. Like the triggers happen and stuff happens with the people they're interviewing, and then that just further expands the mystery, right? Because then you're like, okay, so this isn't just one step removed, now it's right in front of this documentarian, which is the one we're following, which puts it one step closer to us, the audience, right? And so, yeah, it does feel like the noose is tightening a little bit. The circle is closing in at a certain point. And I got to say, like I mentioned in the intro, you got the King's, not that this is any way a Stephen King adaptation, but you have a little bit of his distrust in organized religion, because there is something that is happening. Somehow the local preacher, played by the wonderful John Golson, by the way, he's an Austin institution. If you know him, you've seen him at a million screenings, and he always blows me away every time I've seen him in something. He always takes it up a notch, and I think he's particularly good here as the preacher who you kind of like, even if you're like me and don't really have a healthy trust in organized religion. You kind of like this guy, but there's also something weird about this guy, and I think that he plays that very well. So
he's got like J.D. Pritzker vibes, like kind of seems like an avuncular guy you can trust, somebody you'd ask to help you if you had like a pipe break in your house or something, you know, but he seems like a likable uncle, but also there's a dark side there that the movie hints at, and but he plays it on the sunny side. I like his performance a lot.
Yeah, John is so good in the film. And the initial sort of idea for that character, his name is Reverend Endicott, was a more traditionally ominous character, a tall, lanky, 70-year-old man. And then we were talking to John about a different role, and he wanted to read the whole script. So we sent it to him, sure. And then he texted me, he was like, can I audition for Reverend Endicott? Because I have a take on this. And he sent us some videos of some televangelists in the Houston area that he had kind of grown up with that were, you know, shorter, more, less, not immediately ominous the same way that we were writing it. And we were like, oh, this is an interesting take on it. Let's see you do that. And he blew us away from the first time he auditioned and then every day on set. And because he has a familiarity and background with that, he was able to do improv or recite Bible passages that we were like, hey, you know, we're just going to film some B-roll of you reading Bible passages. Because in the movie, he has a sort of public access show. And we had initially thought a lot of that would play silently. And then he would just like, oh, I'll pull up this passage. And he would flip to it in the Bible because he knew where it was. And he would be able to read it and act it out like sort of on a blank. And it brought a lot to it. And then we went, okay, well, that's no longer B-roll. That's now an actual part of the film. And he kept just bringing it.
The opening of the film, which is also heavily featured in the trailer, if anybody's seen the trailer, it's the part where he's reaching the hand out and you know, telling you to pray with him. That was just John going, hey guys, can I try something? That was just one take. That's the opening, like, 90 seconds of the movie. It's just one unbroken take. Just first try at that. We like Peter said, we saw that. We're like, well, I don't know where, but that's in the movie. And I think that's the first thing we threw on the timeline was, like, that to open the film.
I think, you know, living in Austin, it's a very creative film community here, right? So you see a lot of people making short films. You have a lot of friends making short films, features, whatever. And you have a lot of friends that are like, oh, yeah, I'm going to appear in this. And you go, okay, you did a good job. Like, when I see John pop up and something like, no, you're legitimately, like, an actor's actor, right? Like, you, like, he's got a little John Goodman character actor to him. He's funny as fuck. He's in, you know, he does improv a lot. But he's like, every time I see him, I don't know why it surprises me, because at this point, this is like the third or fourth time where I've watched him in something and gone, huh, he's actually a really good actor.
I feel like he's right on the cusp of just, like, breaking out and being in the next Judd Apatow movie or Marvel movie or something. Like, right. It's going to happen in, like, within 24 months.
Yeah. If you could cast him in a Stephen King story, what character would he play?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Dolores Claiborne.
Man, I don't know. I'm trying to think.
Well, the thing about Golson is he can play creepy, he can play kind. You know, I could see him killing anything from, you know, just looking at something like, you know, the Stand. I can see him killing anything from Tom Cullen being the nice, you know, you gotta love him, you know, loyal guy, to, I don't know, even Lloyd Henry. You know, it's like, I think he's got the range. He could be the nice sidekick or the shitty sidekick. He could be the cult leader. He could, I mean,
yeah,
it does open up the door. Yeah. I think he could be a good bannerman too. He could be a good sheriff.
That's who
character.
I was thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. He could track down Frank Dodd in the dead zone and then succumb to Cujo.
Yeah. He can have a good sense of sort of, he's very approachable, and you want to, as you were saying, like, he you want to like him on screen. He just has that sort of aura, but he can sort of switch into a position of authority or menace in a surprising ease. So I think he actually could slot into a lot of characters. I mean, I'd love to see him in Misery. Like, I think that he would be very good. Chained to a bed and sort of just trying to talk his way out of out of a lot of mess. I could see that.
Could we put him in a version of Misery where he's doing the adaptation thing and he's playing both roles?
Yeah, that rules. I love that. I would watch. I want to make that now. Peter, can we pitch that? Let's cut this. Yeah. We need to pitch this.
He is Paul Sheldon and Annie Wilkes. Yes.
John where Wilson I could, and John Golson.
Misery. I could see this guy as Danforth, Buster Keaton, the selectman, like the sort of pseudo mayor of Castle Rock and Needful Things, because he has that combination of charm, desperation, and darkness that, like, he has to be a nice guy. He's a salesman. What does he sell, Eric? Is it like boats or something?
Boats,
salesman?
Yeah.
You know,
it's been forever since I've seen Needful Things. Is the character's name Danforth?
His name is Danforth, but everybody calls him Buster Keaton, and he doesn't like that.
Interesting. Yeah. The name of the character who is in the footage in Man Finds Tape who gets hit by a van is named Danforth. So it's
I don't think we realized that.
Bleeding
cosmic
into the universe.
Coincidence. Well, yeah.
Well, I think it's more like we subconsciously put that in and didn't realize. But one of branching off of the actor conversation for a moment, one of the cool things about this process of making this kind of fake documentary is what all of the actors brought to the roles and the commitment that they put in, which we had early discussions with everybody that we needed people who were going to push back on whatever we wrote, whatever we asked them to do. Like Kelsey, who plays Lynn, the lead, you know, so much of her performance is also what we're seeing on camera in a lot of those found footage elements. And, you know, we really trusted each other and you know, so we'd be blocking things out and Peter would be like, okay, yeah. And now you stand here and get just like this perfect shot of this effects moment. And she'd be like, there's no way I would stand there. I wouldn't get closer. I'd be getting further away. And we're like, shit, yeah. You're right. And then we would kind of rethink it and reshape it. But so many elements of it, like Nell Kessler, who plays Wendy, so much of what happens in her interview, we kind of wrote, but then she expanded on it and brought original ideas. There's a really emotional like couple minutes in the third act that was all basically just her improvising. There's scenes that were, like we mentioned with John, scenes that were added, things, questions he asked. And so it was a really cool part of the process of making this kind of a film, as opposed to a kind of traditional single camera narrative, because we just had so much room to experiment and play and try things or change major character death scenes, like shoot it on a GoPro 1 week before we submitted to Tribeca, like things like that, you know, that you couldn't do on a budget like this for, you know, a traditional narrative.
And Vespi, I can't remember if we talked about this or not, but there was actually originally a plan to have a KingCast cameo in Man Finds Tape. We had this whole thing where we were going to have content creators and stuff talking about the tapes. And so have an audio element, a podcasty element, like play clips from people talking about things. And we went over to Luke and Tony's to film a segment that ended up actually not being in the film, but we shot it and Wampler was there and we were talking and I was like, oh, hey, would you guys ever do this? And he was like, oh, of course. And so we were getting very close to making that happen. Obviously, you know, Wampler's passing made that impossible, but he was volunteering your services right away.
And that sounds like Scott.
Yeah, and we also kind of actually interrupted a recording of an episode of The Spiel when we were filming because he was watching 1941, and he came out to sort of take a break and talk to us because he was moaning about the movie.
Yeah, he fucking hated it.
and then begrudgingly went back to watch it. And I think he actually talks about it a bit in the episode. But that was so that you were on camera in the background, even though you didn't realize it because we were shooting while you were doing the podcast.
Well, that tracks. That would have been fun. Speaking of, this is a weird tangent, but the only other time that that's kind of happened, even though we weren't playing ourselves, was the that Life of Chuck thing that happened, right? And and I just I got a SAG waiver. We both got SAG waivers or whatever for being able to do it, have voices in a movie, even though we weren't part of the guild. And so there's a whole process where they had to like get us approved to do it, even though we're not guild members, but it's still through guild terms. It's all this weird shit. But I just got a letter from SAG-AFTRA like 2 days ago. I'm like, oh no, what's this? I got residuals from Life of Chuck. I got a $6 check from the Life
You're
of Chuck.
You're rich. Hollywood, that's baby. Awesome.
What are you going to spend it on, Eric?
Half of a Happy Meal, I think, is the thought. Well, maybe one pack of cards tonight. I think some of these nerds might be joining me for some very nerdy shit, going to the local game store and playing the pre-release for the new Magic the Gathering set. So so maybe that's what it'll be. Maybe, and that I'll pull the best card that's worth hundreds and hundreds of dollars out of the new Avatar, The Last Airbender Magic set.
And I was going to buy you a booster pack tonight as a thank you, but now that I know you're flush with that Life of Chuck money.
$6.
I got that Life of Chuck money.
Can you even buy a Magic booster pack for $6 now?
With tax, probably not.
Yeah. He'll be bumming a dollar off of us, Peter.
Yeah. I will be definitely hitting you up for the difference. So you mentioned, you know, things that might have subconsciously made its way into this based on your Stephen King stuff. So I think that perfectly tees us into your Stephen King origin stories. So do you want to hit us up with that?
We should also say before you dive into that, for people who are just listening on audio, Peter and Paul both have a lot of King stuff in the background of their offices. You both have Dark Tower posters, but not the same poster, right?
No, it's the same one.
Oh, it's the same exact poster?
Drew Struzan one, yeah.
Yeah, it's the Drew Struzan one that he painted for Darabont for The Mist, and then they as a nice little homage to a movie that never, because he was a movie poster artist in that movie, and Mondo ended up doing that print right with Struzan back in the day, and they're like, hey, we're actually gonna print this poster, which is obviously Clint Eastwood. It's just obscured enough so Clint Eastwood and his estate can't sue them for printing that, but yeah.
Exactly. That's a great line. R.I.P. to Drew Struzan, who just passed away too, man. He left us with some great imagery and beautiful posters that conjure the spirit of movies. So cool. I just wanted to give people a little background of what's happening in the visuals here.
We're big Stephen King fans, and just for that Dark Tower poster, one of my biggest regrets was there was a prop auction, this was, you know, 10 plus years ago, for stuff from The Mist, and the screen used painting was up for auction, and I put in a bid, and then I kind of forgot about it, and so I wasn't there to actually like do counter bids, and it only went for like $600 or something like that. I was like, what the fuck?
Are you
like,
talking about the torn up one? Are you talking about do you know who won the bid, Peter?
Don't tell me.
Our friend Rod.
Rod Paddock.
Rod Paddock. He has it.
And he
apparently I didn't know I was bidding against Rod.
And I don't know if this is still the case. Get in touch with him because he was trying to offload it to me a few months ago. So and I'm like, dude, I'm getting married and going on a honeymoon. I'm in no position to buy a prop right now.
I will text Rod after this. Wow, what a small world.
Yeah, he showed it to me over at his place like a few months ago. Yeah.
And Rod, for those listening, you know, he again is just a local Austin film nerd guy. Good dude. He pops up in
Man Finds Tape.
Right. Yeah. He's in the congregation, and I saw him and his son were in the credits, right? So
wow.
Well, there you go. Small world. Yes.
So what's the Stephen King origin story? Let's start. Who wants to go first? Paul or Peter?
Peter will go first.
I'll go first. So I have a weird path for it where I distinctly I have the sort of not knowing it was Stephen King at the time. There was a day at school, in middle school, I'm 40 years old now, so this was, you know, mid, early 90s, where I had forgotten to get a permission slip signed to watch some film in class. I don't remember what it was. It was like Twister or something. And so I had to go to the library while everyone else got to watch this movie. And so I was browsing the library and I pulled Eyes of the Dragon off of the school library shelf and read it. And so that was the first book of his that I ever read. But it didn't click with me that Stephen King was a thing, that he wrote it or whatnot. And then one of my favorite movies growing up was Stand By Me. I would taped it off of HBO, watched it over and over and over, but it never clicked to me that it was a Stephen King thing, even as I started to sort of know that Stephen King was a horror guy and a writer and whatnot. The first time that I actively engaged in, oh, I want to seek out Stephen King, was The Gunslinger. My high school job was I worked in the kitchen of a seafood shack. It was a very sort of ramshackle operation. And in the bathroom, there were two things stacked on the back of the toilet. One was a Playboy and one was a copy of The Gunslinger. And I would
the two paths of your life.
Jackpot. Right,
like one or the other here.
Depending on what mood you're on. Yeah, you're in. Yeah,
I would take long bathroom breaks to go read The Gunslinger.
Huh?
Meanwhile, everybody else there is like, Peter's in there a while.
And so that was my Stephen King origin story, was holding up a Playboy and The Gunslinger and choosing The Gunslinger.
That feels like a scene that Stephen King would write, by the way. Like, yeah. You know, just, oh, my summer job at this ramshackle crab shack or whatever.
You're at the end of The Last Crusade, and you chose wisely. Yeah,
that's my story. Oh, yeah. I was hooked. I was hooked ever since then, and became an avid reader. I mean, it's one of those things that there are huge books of his that I've sort of kind of avoided because I'm like, oh, I want to look forward to reading that later. So I don't have the exhaustive knowledge that I wish I had, but I'm a huge, huge fan.
Yeah, yeah. For me, I guess this would have been around 90. So I don't know, I was 5 years old, 6 years old or something. And I just remember, and I don't, it might've just been a commercial or I saw part of it on TV, but it was the It, TV movie. And it terrified me. Just, I can remember it was, you know, Pennywise and the, Tim Curry is Pennywise, right? In the sewer. And it terrified me. And I always, I've always been interested in scary things, and this probably leads to why I became a filmmaker interested in making horror movies. But at a young age, the way I dealt with the things that scared me was by trying to understand them or control them. And so I remember being like a 5-year-old laying in my bed in Ohio, and just, I somehow mentally came up with the concept of holding a town hall meeting in my head with all of the things that scared me. Pennywise, Chucky, all of these things. And I would just like lay there trying to sleep. Imagine like the bureaucracy of like of like just having a meeting with all these people and you know, banging a gavel for some reason. And that's how I kind of dealt with it. But Pennywise was in my, that image of Tim Curry as Pennywise was in my brain from a very early age and kind of infected me. And once I was old enough to read, I want to say I was about 11, maybe 12. And the first King book I read was It. And again, I think it was that just wanting to understand what it was all about. What this, you know, creature person that I saw on TV was, and being able to wrap my head around it. I don't know how well I read it or understood a lot of what was going on in it at that age. And I think my mom wasn't a huge fan of me reading like books like that early, but she was a fan of me reading. So it was kind of that weird balance of not wanting to, you know, discourage me reading.
And you didn't tell her about the end of the book with the kids in the sewer.
I think I maybe just did not understand that as a kid. I didn't understand what they were talking about. Yeah. And then, you know, similar to Peter, I think that was kind of like my entry point, but I wouldn't have considered myself a Stephen King fan at that point, but it was The Gunslinger that got me. And actually I think I was in high school. And then that sucked me into The Dark Tower and just kind of, and that, you know, that's kind of the centerpiece of everything. And you branch off from that. And like Peter, I'm not super well versed like you guys are. Like I've read some stuff, but there's a lot I would love to read. Just need more time.
You guys, I have some great news. Roll out the red carpet, sound the trumpets, light the signal fires to alert the neighboring villages. Lumi Labs has come home. That's right, our longest sponsor is back. Consistent, mellow, and super delicious Lumi gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-the-day de-stressor, a midday mood boost, or help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi Gummies has a strain that's right for you. Now, I have the sleep schedule of a vampire. I've been very open and honest about this. My circadian rhythm is all kinds of fucked up. It always has been. I don't know why. But if left to my own devices, I will end up on a dawn-to-dusk sleep schedule, which isn't helpful for my productivity or interacting with any normal human beings. So I take a Lumi gummy or two when it's time for me to go to bed, let it kick in, and send me off to dreamland as peaceful and relaxed as you please. That's my preferred way to do it. Lumi gummies come in sativa, indica, and hybrid style, so however you want to take the edge off or get a relaxed, creative boost, they have an option for you. Lumi gummies are available nationwide. Go to lumigummies.com, that's LumiGummies.com, and use the code KINGCAST for 30% off of your order. You heard that correctly, 30% off. That's Lumi gummies, LumiGummies.com, code KINGCAST, to lumigummies.com, code KINGCAST. And now, back to the show.
What made you guys choose Joyland as the book you wanted to talk?
Joyland, it's one of those things that in my head, I thought this book came out like 5 years ago. Like this, it's we're in that time zone, at least I am in my brain, where like anything that was 15 years ago feels like it was 5 years ago. So it was kind of a fresh title in my mind. It wasn't until I went to go look at it, I was like, oh, this book is actually like 12 years old.
Yeah, I didn't realize that either.
But I love it. I remember the first time that I picked it up, I read it in, I'm not the fastest reader, and I read it very quickly for my sort of speed of reading books. I just devoured it. I love the sense of romanticized nostalgia in it. I love the setting of it. I think it has a really strong ending, which, you know, is not always the case with some of Stephen King's books. And I just, I love the vibe of it. So I flagged it to Paul because I thought it was also a short book. So I was like, we could catch back up on this soon. Yeah. I didn't realize that Paul had already read it. So he and I have not actually talked about this, at least as far as I know, but I'm a huge fan of it.
Kind of a coming of age story more than a like a monster story. Yep. It's this kid is in a park, as Eric said. There's rumors of ghosts inside the horror ride. What is it that you connect? What do you like about Joyland? Like, what is it that resonates for you?
For me, it has that same sort of wistful looking back that you get from something like The Body, and it's got just enough horror and supernatural elements that it, you know, it counts as a genre title, but it really is for me more of just a deeply personal looking back on one's life kind of story. And I, even though I didn't grow up going to these kind of theme parks that he describes here, this sort of pier-esque cinema, I picture it. I'm curious what you guys all think of the scale of Joyland is. He does describe it briefly, but to me, it's like the Santa Monica Pier times like four. But then there's sometimes that it feels like a sprawling Six Flags. Like, how big do you picture the actual park being when you read it?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, and there's this place called Kennywood, which is like goes back to the early 1900s. And, you know, wooden roller coasters and kind of a carnival atmosphere. It wasn't small. Like, you could spend a lot of time looking for your friends there if you were trying to meet up in the pre-cell phone days. But it also wasn't like Disneyland where you needed a tram to get around, you know? So I felt like, yeah, just like a decent sized permanent amusement park, as opposed to like a, you know, like every town has like a little carnival that rolls through with the with sort of the badly put together tilt-a-whirls and things. And this is a little more permanent. And yeah, that was my sense of it.
Yeah.
Like a Coney Island, almost like Coney Island.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I think it's slightly smaller than a Coney Island. You know, it King describes it in the book as,
yeah,
as like, you know, it would feel small compared to Disney World, but it's not, you know, for this small town, it's actually a pretty big deal. I definitely get the feeling that it's, you know, it's on its last legs, and you know, you by the end of the book, you find out that it's shuttered not too long after the main character exits that story, and so it feels like it's run down, and you know, it's very more carny focused than mm-hmm. you would imagine a lot of these places would be, and that's kind of what I like about it. I like that there's a little community there. It's like this other world that exists within our world, even within that small town. Once you step in there, and then suddenly they all have their own like kind of hierarchy. They have, you know, the carny for carny, they have their own like talk, and you know, how they call all the people that attend Coney's, you know, because they're like, you know, frightened little rabbits and shit, you know, and marks and stuff. Like it's to me, you know, I wanted to point out, you know, something that Peter said, where it's just like, it does have that nostalgic looking back feeling. It's set in the 70s. You do have that kind of coming of age, you know, the main character is in his early 20s. I think he's 21. He's like college age. Which takes it out of the running for me. I don't know if you guys agree with me, but when I hear coming of age, if it's not like, to me, that's a very specific time. It's a Stand By Me time. Like it's kind of a thing that aggravates me a little bit when I hear people describe coming of age stories is like, and then this, you know, 24-year-old leaves the nest for the first, like, no, that's not coming of age.
Well,
to me, coming of age,
it's all relative,
is,
I guess, right?
And there's no like tablet handed down to Moses that tells you what the coming of age actually means. But to me, it's a very specific moment transitioning from boyhood to manhood or girlhood to womanhood. You know, it's very puberty kind of centric. It's leaving the child behind,
right,
and going into an adult phase. Like that to me is what coming of age means. But I totally get it as shorthand for this character who is, you know, the main character Devin is this character in transition. He is this guy who, you know, thinks he has the love of his life. He, you know, he's gonna go his childhood sweetheart, who he's madly in love with. Obviously, she breaks his heart, and this is the summer he spends brokenhearted, and he's working in this kind of seaside carny thing. And so it is a moment of transition, which I get. It
reminds me a lot of Adventureland, that movie with Kristen Stewart Jesse Eisenberg. I think Greg, Bill Hader's in it, Kristen Wiig. But it's, which was actually shot at that Pittsburgh amusement park that I was telling you guys about. Yeah.
Really?
I remember seeing the movie and being like, that's the Potato Patch. Like, I know that place. So, but with a supernatural element, like, what do you guys make of the ghostly aspects of this story? Because it's also not like the most terrifying book. Mm. It's not about the dark side of human nature. It's about something a little more warm and
the supernatural
and heartwarming.
Part. Yeah. I mean, the lead up to the supernatural part is definitely the dark side of human nature.
Yeah, it's true.
The mystery investigated.
There's a couple things I wanted to mention real quick before the supernatural part, which is just kind of tapping what we were talking about the nostalgia of it all. I think nostalgia is such a powerful drug that when written properly, we kind of tap into that drug by reading someone else's nostalgia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have either any of y'all read Haruki Murakami's Norwegian Wood? I read it earlier this year. He wrote it in 87. But it's similar in that it's told from the perspective of an older man who's now a writer who is recalling his past when he was about this age, like 20, 21, in college and dealing with life and death and all that kind of stuff. So it was weird because I read Joyland, you know, a dozen years ago, and but then reread it in the past week. And it was strange how these books are almost kind of like sister stories to each other. Just one's from Japan and one's from America with very different perspectives. But I think that's why people like we just kind of love stuff like this, because it taps into that emotional feeling of nostalgia. It's not your own past, but you can connect to it emotionally. As for Anthony, your question about the supernatural elements, it was funny because in my memory of reading it, it had more of that in there. Reading it now, it's kind of like, oh, this is like maybe 10% of the whole book.
Yeah.
Maybe I was kind of thinking about how if anybody were to ever adapt it into a film, any studio would be like, yeah, we gotta ratchet that up. We need more of the creepy supernatural stuff. But I love that about it, about how minimal and light touch that element is. It definitely has a third act that, you know, goes there, but like it stays true to what the story is about and the character, the main character, Dev, and what he's experiencing, because it doesn't, it also makes the supernatural part feel real within the context of that nostalgia, because it's like, it doesn't get overpowered by it. It's like, oh yeah. And then there was just the part of my life where there was like a ghost child and that sort of thing. But it's not, you know, it has the same weight as kind of like his relationship with the girl who dumps him.
Right.
You know, these things have equal weight. And that, to me, the math of it all, the math of the creativity makes it all feel realistic.
The main character never sees the ghost. This is a ghost story in which the main character never sees the ghost. The supernatural stuff he's exposed to is more akin to Danny Torrance in The Shining. Like, he starts seeing more third sight kind of, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Things with the Roz, who's the, you know, kind of the resident old Jewish grandmother that doubles as the Romanian mystic and psychic, who might actually have a little bit of psychic touch. Like, and she has some stuff that comes true. She has a lot of stuff that doesn't, right? And then, you know, in the form of this kid, this poor dying boy named Mikey, who is very much like more of a concentrated version of a second sight thing. So yeah, it's weird. This is a ghost story in which the main character never sees the ghost. He becomes a little obsessed with it and wanting to see it. Other people around him see it, which is leads into what you're saying, where like, yeah, this feels realistic. That feels like me. Like, I want to believe. I'm kind of a cynic when it comes to this stuff, and I think a lot of that's rooted in the fact that I don't have any particular religious faith, so I don't really believe much in an afterlife, period. So you know, but like, I love horror shit and I would love to see a ghost. Guillermo del Toro is the exact same way. He said he's heard ghosts, but he's never seen one. And I guess he just bought a notoriously haunted house in England. And he's moving there. And I saw him talking on a talk show while promoting Frankenstein. And he was so excited to move in because he really wants to see a ghost. He's like, he's heard ghosts, and he has a pretty creepy story about hearing a ghostly murder happen at a haunted hotel, but he never saw anything. And the way, of course, Guillermo tells it is so rich and charismatic. But yeah, that's how it is in my experience. You hear people who say that they've seen things, but you haven't seen it yourself.
Yeah, that's what I like about the supernatural aspect of this, is that it's a very much so, for the character, a sort of I want to believe. It's peppered in at the beginning, and then it slowly bubbles to the surface and matters more. But I'm like you, Eric. I'm a skeptic who wants it to happen. I've actually sort of forgot about this until just now, but I'm half British, and on my British side, my grandma told me this story once. Who she was a very sort of stereotypical British woman, nothing overly, you wouldn't believe that she would believe in this, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. She casually dropped this story once, how when she was in her 20s, they were driving in a car. They went, her and another couple, so my grandparents, another couple, went to go see a psychic, like on a lark. And it sounds like a very sort of Agatha Christie setup, where the psychic was doing like fortune telling, and they weren't really buying into any of it. And then as they were leaving the shop, the psychics grabbed my grandma's arm and said, "You'll know when to stop." And she was like, "What does that mean?" And then the person didn't elaborate, and they left, and they were driving back. And it was a very London foggy night, and they sort of lived outside of the city. And so it got foggier and foggier. And my grandma in the back seat suddenly yelled, "Stop." And so my grandfather slammed on the brakes. And then they got out, and there was a sinkhole in front of the car.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's like those kinds of stories that, like, they always happen to somebody else. And I'm like, right. I want something like that to happen to me. But that's, yeah, that kind of event seems like something that would happen in a joy.
Yeah.
What do you fellas make of the spice content of the book? Because, you know, the hard case, I've got the hardback illustrated edition of Joyland here from Hard Case. And the cover is clearly selling this lady who only has...
That's definitely more sultry than the paperback, which also still has a fair amount going on.
The paperback has a babe in like a cool, sort of cool green sundress. But this is, she's not the ghost, is she? She's got a little sheet, I see, but that's about it. What do you make of...
Annie.
What do you make of the, you know, the Hard Case crime always leans into that pulp cover thing where they put a super sexy cover on some schmo's, you know, a heartfelt coming of age story.
And he never pays off. Sex appeal.
That's part of this book, that it's, mm-hmm. it's kind of outside of the traditional Stephen King fiction that you would expect, you know, the big giant letters on the hardcover book that you see in Target or whatever, or Barnes and Noble. Like this one, I feel like if you're not paying attention, you might not even realize on the shelf that it's Stephen King, because it doesn't look like his other books. And if anybody listening, you should look up the cover for the book. But I love that. I mean, yeah, it is misleading, and it's kind of like the paperback one. That's what I got too. It's kind of like, yeah, maybe there's like a brief moment that kind of feels like this, like towards the end on the cover. But it's like what I was saying about if a studio is adapting this, it's definitely they're going to be like, we need more of that. We need more of what's on the cover, more of that energy.
This cover's by Glenn Orbick. I'm not sure who does the cover on your version.
It's also Glenn Orbick on the... This is how the Hollywood girls are described. Joyland, that go around taking the pictures. So at least this one is supposedly, you know, theoretically a character from it, but the one that you just showed, that definitely doesn't...
He's just got that painting laying around. He's like, how about this one, Steven?
She's got the rifle. Which character is this then?
That's Annie.
Annie. Yeah, the mother of the dying child.
Yeah, the hot mom. Yeah, hot mom of the dying kid. Yeah, it's a character that's, and this is also very interesting too. And I have to think it goes back to process, because the way Stephen King writes, as we've mentioned many, many times on the show, is that he doesn't really outline anything, so he's just going with the flow of the story. And this all originated based on an image he had of a little boy flying a Jesus kite on the beach, which is something that pops up early. But then doesn't become anywhere near a part of the story until over halfway through the book. And that's when you're introduced to this single mother and her very sick kid. This motherfucker, the way that he writes these characters, like the mom is kind of shitty at first, but she's, you know, but she's just very guarded and she's still sweet in her own way. And like within like, I don't know, 5 pages of meeting these guys, I'm like, oh, I want to be, can I be the stepdad? I want to step in here. Like I'll help, you know, like, oh, you know, this family's broken and they need support and all this stuff. But it's crazy how, like, if you were outlining this, you would have gotten to the point in the brainstorming process where you're like, okay, so you're going to meet these characters and you go, well, we can't meet them 60% into the story. We got to bump that up earlier, but it works for King and it's such a very Stephen King-y thing to do, especially in these kind of shorter novels that he writes where it, you know, he's just doing the stream of consciousness thing and he sticks with it. He doesn't go in and double down on it. He'll pepper in a few things, you know, earlier on, where there's mention of these and he sees them and sees the dog and, you know, and all this stuff on his walk in. But like, you know, the fact that he doesn't make him a part of the story officially until halfway through is crazy.
Yeah, his process is not one that I think Paul and I could do. We are very much sort of brainstorming. We have to know the beginning, the middle, the end of something. The idea,
at least broadly, where we're going. Yeah,
yeah, and figuring out along the way is fascinating to me. And I was wondering for this one, because this one does feel a bit more pre-planned, because it does take a while to introduce some of the most important characters. And it's kind of like, if he hadn't thought of them. Was it just going to be a murder mystery? Like, where does it come? The sort of the investigation of who actually committed the murder does feel a bit more, the conclusion of it, a bit more abrupt of like, oh, well, maybe by the way, it was this guy.
It's almost, and I love this about it, it's almost forgotten for a lot of the book. Uh-huh. And then literally the one of the Hollywood girlfriend literally shows up and is like, oh, hey, I researched it.
Which again, this is amazing when you're talking about point of view, because again, in any other, you know, throw my dog under the bus again. If this was a Dean Koontz book, you would have had him like doing all the research and in the library.
In the library.
But he's doing what he does. He puts on the fur, as they say. He dances as the mascot, the dog, Howie the dog. He's doing his job. He's, you know, painting rides and shit. And then all of a sudden, this, you know, girl that he had been part of his friend group that went off to college, she comes back with a fucking stack of research going, all right, here's some photos, here's this, you know, here's the guy that killed this girl. You know, I think we should say the central mystery is that there's a woman who was murdered in the haunted house. And this is also something that's really, as somebody who loves Haunted Mansion like I do, you know, I love the idea that in the horror ride in this theme park, that a murder, and you know, not only did somebody die in there, it was a murder. And not only was it a murder, it was a murder that people didn't think, that they literally saw the body the day that it happened and thought it was just part of the show.
Part of the thing. That I like.
It's such a great thing. But I do love how the investigation isn't just, you know, doesn't take up a huge part of it. I feel like he's scratching that itch a lot with the Holly books, where you're getting into the nitty gritty of the investigation, and this is kind of before he dove like with both feet into these murder mystery things, these crime novels. And to me, that's one of the strengths of the story, much in the same way that one of the strengths of the story is the killer revealing himself, because he mm-hmm. thinks he's caught, but he's not yet. And it's very possible this dude, if he didn't panic and make the threats that he made thinking that he was caught, he could have slipped away and avoided the fate that would befall him by the end of this the story. Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of had to have evolved. I'm just, you know, theorizing here, from King's writing process of not having meticulous outlines.
Yeah.
Because he's not setting up some game of 4D chess murder mystery. It's just kind of like, oh yeah, I said there was a murder, so I'm going to get back to that and figure it out. Which I like. I like the sort of the soft touch there, the same way he has the sort of soft touch on the supernatural. Both of them are just sort of enough to linger in the back of your mind and give a sort mm-hmm. of somewhat sinister color to everything until the third act, when he really cranks that knob. And then there's the beautiful symmetry. I think the ending of this, the sort of finale of when he goes back and they spread the boy's ashes, is genuinely moving and is one of the more of like emotional things I've ever read from King. I think the first time I read it, I remember crying at the end. I was like, whoa, again, based on the cover, based on what you think this book is going to be, I didn't think that it would go the way that it did. It's a really, really special book.
I love and am fascinated by art that kind of like sneaks under the rug what it actually is. Mm. Like, I love that this book has this cover and you don't realize by the end of it, like, yeah, you're going to have tears in your eyes, like, because it's genuinely an emotional story. Talking about the, you know, King's process. So when Peter and I started writing our book, The Dead Friends Society, back in 2020, that was like our pandemic project. We both read, well, Peter reread it, but I read On Writing, and we both talked about, there was so much we got out of that, but the one thing that we both were like, can't do that, is his process of just start writing and see where it goes. And we're like, we just, our brain, if we don't know where the train is going, we don't know what to write next. So I don't know. I'm envious of that kind of a creative process. I wish I could do it.
It's a superpower, is it not? I mean, that's, mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah, totally.
He is the outlier there. Most people don't write off the cuff like that. And, you know, that's not saying that there isn't a process for him, right? There is. That's not saying that he doesn't, you know, revise after the fact and then pepper stuff in, you know, once he stumbles upon it later. You know, he's talked at length, I think, about his editorial process. He'll finish a book 2 years before it comes out. You finish the first draft, and then he will, you know, he then like spends his time going back and forth between writing the next thing, and then he splits his day. Is my understanding is he'll do that, and then he'll do, you know, half of his day writing his 2,000 words, and then he'll do half of his day revising and editing the previous manuscript. So, yeah.
Another thing I love about the book too, kind of tapping into nostalgia, but just it's hard to write a good serial killer story nowadays. Because by the end of this book, you kind of realize like, oh, this is actually like a serial killer kind of story. We're only getting a little piece of that. But in just like the modern day surveillance state, it's like if you're trying to write any kind of a serial killer kind of a story now, like there's just no way to avoid cameras everywhere, technology everywhere, phones everywhere, like as a part of the story. But there's something about, again, this is tapping into the nostalgia element. There's something about reading a story where you realize it's about a serial killer where they don't have the technology to do that. And so the only way to do it is like, by looking really close at a photograph and realizing it's not what you think. And I love that. And it makes me wonder, like, I'm sure there's some brilliant story, serial killer take coming, but like, I'm kind of like, are the best serial killer stories like trapped in time? Like, do they have to be set before the 90s? I don't know.
Well, there are fewer serial killers now. If you think about like the heyday of them, like the 60s, 70s, 80s, where like, you know, the Zodiac could disappear. You're right. Right now, it would be like, you know, when that dude shot the healthcare executive in the back of the head on a New York street, like, in years gone by, that
Mario's
guy would have
brother.
Got...
Sorry.
Yes.
What's that?
Bad joke.
He's Mario's brother.
That guy would have gotten away with it in years past.
Yeah.
Or at least it would have taken a long time, and you know, to track him down. And now it's like, okay, let's call up all the ATM cameras in the area. You know, let's look at the 7-Elevens
from a fucking McDonald's employee or whatever the fuck.
But also you can disseminate the footage wider, faster, and you know, you can track things down. And you know, I wonder if there's like a Discord somewhere where serial killers are like, guys, if they're like journalists that get together and like, man, it used to be so great back in the 80s. Serial killers are like, yeah, you know, you used to just be able to disappear a kid and now, you know.
Yeah.
You try to coax one kid into your car with some lollipops and you're already on the Ring Network.
Yeah.
Woke culture, right? Oh, jeez.
Make America great again is what we're saying.
Yeah.
That's need to go back. Well, we talked a little bit about okay, so Stephen King writes very cinematically, whether it's a big epic like The Stand or It or this. I read this and I see the movie in my head. Right.
Same.
This is like I can smell the salt of the sea. I can, you know, I can feel his sex stuff in this is less cringy than it usually is, but it's still a little Stephen King cringy, which I would actually be disappointed if it wasn't. But it's also, you know, I got to say it's kind of effective, you know, because you're also falling in love with Annie at this point. But I like how they make a point where it's like, yes, this is happening. This is of the moment. This isn't a permanent thing. He isn't new dad, you know, in this scenario. This is a transition still to what his, you know, his full life will be. So you have all that stuff. And I couldn't help but thinking while reading this again, like, we get asked a lot about stuff that hasn't been adapted that should be adapted, and Joyland should be right at the top of the stack for me. That like this is a no-brainer,
100%.
Frank Darabont, you know, Mike Flanagan, the new Frank Darabont, the new Mike Flanagan. You know, this will be their movie that they break out with, right? The new Rob Reiner, right? The next one that will really understand Stephen King and his ability to, make a world you want to live in, create characters that are colorful and grounded and slightly exaggerated, but in a grounded way. Like it's like everything. You got that nostalgia you talked about. You got the time period. So it's like set in the 70s. So you can get that Shawshank effect where it's not modern. So it's not going to age the way that telling a modern story will. You know, it's like, to me, like, all the pieces are there, and the right person to come around and adapt this is going to potentially have a new kind of like modern classic on.
All right, Eric, we'll do it.
Well, I was going to say,
call the studio.
Paul... keep it away from Peter and Paul, by all means.
Paul and Peter have their mission. You've got your mission, should you choose to accept it.
Accept
to make a film out of Joyland.
I would gladly accept it. I'm curious what's going on with it, because I know back in 2018, there was a adaptation of this announced for Freeform, which is like a sort of young adult TV network. Obviously, it never got off the ground. I'm curious if the rights have reverted back and they're available now. But that I remember at the time thinking, well, that's a weird way to do it.
That's a waste.
I don't know what their take was, but I genuinely thought like, oh, that's a missed opportunity. So I would love if someone, whether it was us or someone else, came along and gave this a proper adaptation, because it is very primed for it.
I would love if the King cast could become a pitch room for future Stephen King projects. Like, yeah. Maybe get some producers, some studio executives listening, Eric, and
it's happened before. I mean, the movie ended up not happening, but the whole reason why Brian Fuller, you know, was hired to adapt Christine was because of his appearance talking about Christine on the show. Like, producers heard that and were like, this is an interesting take. We should explore this.
Our friends who had their Eyes of the Dragon script are still having more conversations about that as a result of our show.
I didn't know that. That's really nice. That's a good
call. I don't know where that's going. But yeah, Paul,
let's
Peter.
Let's get this clipped out on TikTok.
Yeah,
Get the Gen Z
it out there.
For it.
Well, I want to do a little fan casting before we wrap up. Being a movie guy first and foremost, when I read this kind of stuff, I usually plug in like some sort of actor into my mind's eye when I'm reading. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes it's an amalgam of, you know, kind of this morphing face of for the lead character of, in certain moments that remind me of certain actors. But and so when I was reading through this, I was finding it hard to pinpoint specific actors. But thinking about it afterwards, you know, you need somebody in the lead who's in his, you know, late teens, early 20s. And the one that jumped to my mind is Stephen King adjacent, and that's the star of The Black Phone, Mason Thames.
I was going to say, as you were talking, I was immediately picturing Mason Thames.
I was trying to think of anybody else in his age range that could hit. That's known.
Good call.
Obviously, you could do. You know, there's going to be talented actors in that age range that you can find. But in terms of people who you know now, like, I think Mason Thames has the vulnerability. He's got the kind of aw shucks. You believe him as being the guy in the fur, you know, dancing around as the dog and saving people's lives when they're choking on hot dogs. Like, he's the good kid, but also somebody that, you know, has that sadness and rage that could exist, you know, that could be festered or fostered by that. You know,
yeah,
the
he's got the, you know, particularly now that he's, you know, growing up into very much so leading man status, he has that leading man aura, but he also has a very hangdog, like, could easily be sort of down on his luck in a very believable way. So yeah, I think he could definitely easily slot into the lead here. And I would kind of picture the other person that I would imagine for this is Annie is the name of the mom, right?
Yes.
Of Mike's mom. Like Alinda Cardellini, as her. I picture, like, because I think that she should be, you know, a decade or two if older than he is.
Yeah.
And I
think she's in her early 30s in the book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. So has anybody listened to the audiobook?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I read it back when it came out, but then I listened to the audiobook because I was short on time and I was like, I can listen to this at like 1.5x speed to get done in time. I finished it this morning. And Michael Kelly, the actor Michael Kelly, reads the audiobook and he's fantastic at it. And I just like it. I know it doesn't make sense because obviously he's too old to play a 21-year-old, but like that is who is locked in my head.
He could be the Richard Dreyfuss narration if you're taking like
a
narrator, you know, thing.
Yeah.
Which honestly, do that. You know, it worked for Stand By Me. It worked for Shawshank. You know, the narrator.
I would love
version,
it because, you know. I think it's it. I that kind of a movie is pretty rare nowadays. The nostalgia-driven narrated film. Life of Chuck is narrated, right?
It is, but it's Nick Offerman.
Omniscient narrator.
Oh, that's right, that's right. And so I think if we're trying to make this into a movie and trying to tap into everything you were talking about, Eric, of making that work, then yeah, I would have Michael Kelly, you know, in the future, the older version of the main character reading, you know, that narration, telling us a backstory. Cause I think it's all part of everything that goes in the cauldron to put you in that time and place and that feeling.
What about somebody like Gaten Matarazzo? Who has that, he's right on that cusp of like, kind of, he still looks like a boy, he's in his early 20s, but he's got that boyish quality, you know, and I think the character benefits from not being too, what's the phrase, not too grown up, you know, that there has to be a little bit of a like, you might mistake this person for a kid, even though they are a little older.
Although that might make the later scenes even creepier. Yeah. Like, oh, the more kid-like when he loses his virginity.
Not like a little boy, but like, you know, like there's still a boyish quality to that. Yeah,
I think this kind of taps into a little bit of what Eric was talking about earlier, not liking the term coming of age for this kind of age range. And I'm not going to argue it, but I do think there's a thing that can happen to a lot of people in this age range when you're like 19, 20, 21, where you're just kind of a lost soul and your life is kind of what, and that's what this book is about, what this character is about. He's this lost soul and his life is kind of he makes one choice to go work at Joyland and then his life is dictated by all of the things that happen to him. It's kind of like the Harry Potter problem, but done in a way where it's like, yeah, but this is relatable. This is, a lot of people go through this, don't know who they are, and kind of define themselves based on the people that enter their life. And I think having a like Gaten, is that how you say it? Gaten?
Mm-hmm.
Like somebody like him, that's interesting because you're right, like that he's like right on the edge of like boyhood, adulthood sort of thing in his personality. And it can kind of tap into that because it really is kind of a story about a lost soul trying to kind of free a lost soul.
Right.
In the park while finding himself.
Well, I think also we've done throw it out there. I would also throw out Ben Wang. He's a really, really good actor. I actually weirdly haven't
seen him. From The Long Walk, isn't he? Yeah.
But he's great in Karate Kid Legends. He's great in American Born Chinese. He's great in some other stuff. I think he's got that same sort of vulnerability that this character would need, I think. And he's right on that age range cusp of, I think the actor's probably in his, you know, mid 20s at this point, but he can play younger believably, I think.
We've got some casting options. Let's get this in deadline. We'll get some movement, some associate producer credits.
I got one more
credits
I want to throw out there before we start wrapping up. And that is, I want to age her down a little bit. So Roz, who's the psychic that works there, that's, you know, that flips between her persona, which is the Romanian, oh, I am the psychic, oh, I will tell your future, you know, that kind of sham thing, and just being kind of a Jewish ma, grandma, you know, that kind. I think this is a Kate Siegel role. I think you age her down a little, you know, age the character down a little bit, and then you have, I can see Kate just eating up the performance part of it, like the sham psychic one, and really chewing that scenery, and then going to the I'm just the New Yorker. I'm just the New Yorker. I mean, I got this, and I'm going to try to keep you on the straight and narrow. You know, I
can
see her doing that. So I want to throw that.
I love a Kate Siegel shout out. Yeah. So let's, we'll do that. All right. We got a project. Let's get the green light on this.
Excellent. Yeah.
Easy peasy.
It's off the ground.
The whole needing an amusement park to shoot and thing, we'll figure that out. That's easy. No worries.
I mean, get Mason Thames on first. You have your package there because isn't he the youngest now actor to have three like number one movies back-to-back-to-back whatever?
I think so,
So, hey, you got him.
We'll
that's
go
the way
shoot at Dollywood. We're great.
No, you got to do this for real. Like, to me, you have to build up. You need to make this like a... a real budgeted thing. I think you need to build that out. You need to be able to walk around Joyland. Yeah. You need to have the full dark ride aspect. I love that sequence when they go through the dark ride and you're going through the different rooms. You know, they do it specifically so they could try to see the ghost. And maybe this will be a good thing to end on, because not only did one of my favorite aspects of this book is not only did the lead narrator never see the ghost, and wanted to see the ghost, he was there when the ghost sighting happened, and it happened to the one who didn't believe. The one who went in there going, none of this is real, whatever, and this is the one who's shaking to his core. I wonder what Tom's story, that's his character's name, I believe. Like, what? Yeah. Where did he go? Like, he just refused to go back into the park. You know, he when he reveals that he saw this thing, it's somebody who feels like their whole, the axis of their entire world shifted. Which I fucking love. I love that this is a guy who didn't believe in any of that stuff. He saw this. He saw it unwillingly. He didn't want to see it. He didn't want to believe in it. Yet he is the one that saw this thing. And this is and just what that does to that character. Like, that to me is so fascinating. Anyway.
Well the way that Paul and I made Man Finds Tape was we said, we're just making this movie. And then, you know, people sort of hopped on the train as it was leaving. So I think we can just say, yeah, we're making Joyland.
Sure.
Go for it.
We'll forge Stephen King's signature on the option.
Yeah.
Let's make Man Finds Tape a big hit so that you have some momentum. The film is out December 5th. Is that, do I have the date right?
December 5th in New York, LA, Austin, maybe some other markets. I don't know. Magnolia is releasing it, and on VOD everywhere that you rent and buy movies.
Lake Mungo fans, check it out. It's a great companion. That was a comparison you made, right? Is part of your inspiration. I think if you're into that sort of thing, you'll love Man Finds Tape. Paul, Peter, thanks for joining us on the KingCast.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for having us. I've long wanted to do this. I've been a long-time listener, so thanks for having us.
Many thanks to Peter Hall and Paul Gandersman for joining us for that episode. Always love talking about Joyland, and, you know, I like those dudes, too. They're good dudes. I hope you all give their movie a shot. Man Finds Tape. It's VOD in select theaters December 5th. It's one of those great little low-budget shockers that crawls under your skin and kind of sticks around for a little bit. So I think this is the right audience for that movie. The KingCast will be back in 2 weeks, as normal, with another pair of guests. One has been on the show before. The other is brand new, but both are exciting, especially together. And I can't wait to chat with them. It's going to be a fun one. I believe the title that they chose was The Shawshank Redemption, which I guess is fitting because this episode will debut shortly after Thanksgiving. And Shawshank is one of the most Thanksgiving-ass-feeling movies that's ever been made. You know what I mean by that. Here's also your friendly reminder that if you dig the show, the very best way for you to support it is to join the Patreon at patreon.com/thekingcast. Throw us a few bucks every month and you'll get exclusive new bonus episodes, including commentaries, as well as instant access to 5 years of bonus episodes. At the highest tier, you also get into our Discord, which is all sorts of fun. The second best way you can support the show is to rate and review us on your favorite podcatcher and spread the word. If you like an episode, talk about it on social media. That helps us too. And we appreciate each and every one of you listening, and enjoy your Thanksgiving. And I think that's about it. So see you guys in a couple of weeks for our next episode. It's going to be a scream, baby. Adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself, as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler. We'll be right back.